What do you want to talk about again?
No, I want to ask one or two different... I mean, what I want to do at the beginning is to ask one, two or three
questions
at random.
By all means.
And then check some of my things I told about you, whether I was correct or not. How come that you, better equipped of nearly anybody, to deal, let's say, with British society, British history, British personalities, for the very reason that being grown up from within and yet having the possibility to observe phenomena from outside, like so many people you dealt with, how come that you dealt with British history or British personalities less than one would expect? I mean, you didn't write a lot about England, or you wrote, I think, only on the Israeli.
Yes, only because for Jewish reasons.
You wrote about the Israeli?
For Jewish reasons.
Yes. And so why didn't you write about...
Because I don't write about history in general. Who have I written about? I don't write...
All right.
I don't write contemporary history. The only thing was, I was in America during the war, and so I was in some sense impressed by what went on there, and thought I understood their politics. I never, British politics was something I, my attitude towards which was that of most people. I mean, I wasn't specially interested. Neither in that, nor in contemporary British history, I took it for granted. I was not a political observer by nature.
Yes.
I was made one by the war artificially. Yeah. In the 20s and 30s, or 30s, when I was grown up, I was exceedingly detached from politics, history, and these things. Now let's see if that works.
Yes, but see, I mean, cultural movements, literary movements. You wrote about the Enlightenment in Russia. You wrote about, Turgenev, Belinsky, not to mention Herzen, or let's say Sorel, Vico, and everybody. Didn't any English, British thinker attract you, or let's say romanticism in England, that you dealt with so often in Germany? It strikes one, doesn't, isn't it?
It's a very reasonable question. Let me tell you. My real interest was and continues to be ideas. Not special political ideas, but ideas in general. And as you say, certain cultural developments. Funnily enough, my reason for my Russian interest is, of course, my origin. I had a certain nostalgia for the language, which I didn't speak much in England, since the age of 10 or 11, although I read a certain amount. And it became a kind of romantic universe to me, because it no longer existed, because I had memories of Russian Revolution, become almost a kind of historical story, something outside the flow of reality, some sort of, and I don't say fantasy, but anyhow, something which I thought of as one thinks, like something in a book or in a film. And it simply arose partly out of the affinity to the language and my accidental discovery of the writings of Herzen, which was purely accidental. On the shelves of the London Library. I'd hardly heard of him before, and that fascinated me. From there I went on to other things. Of course, the Russian Revolution was a central event of my childhood, and of everything which led to it was of natural interest to me. From there, in a certain sense, from interest in the Russian Revolution, I went on to Marx. From Marx, I went on to ideas in general, particularly in the 18th century, which preceded Marx. And then I found that ideas were expressed much more vividly in much more extreme terms, which made them more interesting, even if it was exaggerated, in France, in Germany, in Russia, and not in England, where ideas never played a central part. And that is why, for example, you might say, what about Burke? Well, I took some interest, but Burke is fundamentally a member of Parliament and a publicist who didn't go very deeply into the analysis of ideas, was not really governed by abstract ideas in the way in which all these fanatics in France, in Russia, in Germany, intelligentsia, think similarly with poetry. German romantic poetry is genuinely romantic. Russian romantic poetry less so, but still romantic. English romantic poetry, queer romanticism, marvelous as it is a pale reflection of German romanticism. Much more so than French romanticism, which is much more extreme, much more violent, in a way more absurd, but therefore more, so to speak, noticeable, more vivid. That is the reason. And the same is true about political ideas. Who had political ideas in England in the 19th century? Mill. I did take an interest in Mill. Carlyle. I've never written about Carlyle, but Carlyle I do read.
Because of historiography?
Because he was a German thinker. Carlyle does not descend from any English don't, and has no, fundamentally no disciples in England. He's in line with German thinkers. That's why Mr. Powell likes him so much. As he himself says, he has much more affinity to German historians, to people like Reitschke, to people like Wagner, people, German nationalism and German romanticism, than it has to anything in England. He really was hostile to the whole atmosphere of 19th century England in which he lived. What other English thinkers can you think of? Who are the ideologists?
Or let's say Bentham. Or Adam Smith, from another angle.
Well, I never in economics, but that was something which I was frightened of. I did it for a year and understood not a word. I was examined in it and repeated propositions which these people had uttered in the hope the examiners would understand them. I did not. So I got perfectly respectful, low second-rate, second-class marks in it. I never understood Ricardo. I didn't really understand Marx's economics until much later. Bentham, yes, he was too dull. Just too dull. He may have been right about many things. And if one is interested in jurisprudence, then of course Bentham has an important, so to speak, deflationary influence on conservatism and traditionalism. But my natural interest is in, I'm afraid, what I take an interest in is rather vividly or pungently or sharply expressed views and not decent common sense, which I take for granted and which I believe in myself. But I was always attracted by, you see, my speciality is, I think, relations with the enemy, by which I mean reading the people who discover chinks in the armor which one takes for granted. And therefore it's more interesting to know what the enemy says against one than to read thinkers with whom one agrees and with whom one takes for granted, and to that extent are slightly tedious.
Yes. Now, I thought that there was another angle to it when it comes, let's say, to political thought. It puzzled me what attracted you to America, to the United States. And I thought...
Nothing.
Something, yes, I believe.
Nothing. I never thought I'd go there.
No, but when you were there...
Ah, I was fascinated.
Fascinated. And I believe that one of the reasons is that here you had an unexpected example of intellectuals and academics that had their impacts on politics, that fulfilled ideas in politics. I mean, the New Dealers. I thought that you were attracted by this kind of personalities or ideas. Let's say, on the one hand, let's say Lenin, Churchill, or personalities that had their impact on history, or that without them history would have had a different shape, or let's say the New Dealers. Or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, but it depends on something else. I think that as a result of my reading of these ideologists, in Russian, German, French, I became much more at home in the 19th century than I ever was in the 20th. And I understood the sort of, for example, liberal ideas in the 19th century were very sympathetic to me. In the 20th century, the whole thing became very mixed up. And I no longer felt powerful pull towards either socialism, conservatism, liberalism in England. Partly because the whole thing had become too moderate. In a way, in spite of the differences of violent differences of political attitude, expressed in rather grey and rather sensible language, whereas the 19th century was full of passionate eloquence, which I'm in favour of. Some people hate rhetoric and loathe eloquence and want flat, truthful, decent, quiet statements. I'm rather attracted by Michelet, by Mazzini, by Herzen, by Carlyle, if you like. I mean,
would
the great writers.
What? Would you include Turgenev?
Turgenev was not eloquent, no. Turgenev is a wonderful writer, but...
That's what I thought, yes.
His ideas are much more like... My ideas are much more like his, like anybody else, probably in the 19th century, in some ways. But...
We'll come to it later.
No, but he wasn't a
I
preacher.
Know. That's why I asked.
He wasn't a preacher, no. But, I mean, I have nothing against eloquence. Yeah. I think there's much to be said for it. There was a certain passion and a certain exaggeration. Otherwise, ideas don't get through. Let me tell you, unless ideas are exaggerated, they don't crack the crust of accepted thought. That is why only the exaggerators have ever had historical good fortune. I think the only non-exaggerators who have ever been remembered have said it somewhere else. Aristotle and Locke, everybody else have exaggerated. That's why they somehow got through. In America, politics were 19th century. Let me explain too. Republicans and Democrats were much more like Disraeli and Gladstone. Much more like, let us say, I don't know what, probably Campbell, Salisbury and Rosebery, that kind of thing. You see, than anything in England. And there one could take sides. Roosevelt stood for exactly what one thought one liked in the Spanish Civil War. It was the same thing. On one side, decent people, liberals, generosity, the working classes, students, intellectuals, rational people. On the other side, clericalism, despotism, traditionalism, feudalism, capitalism.
Of course, Churchill would be, again, one in the 20th century that is 19th century figure.
Churchill, to me, was only a hero because he saved our lives. But he was a 19th
century. I mean,
the
eloquence and
certainly. I didn't sympathize with his views. Yeah. No.
And not the eloquence of the romanticism.
When I met him, I was fascinated, but didn't like him. He was a bit too brutal. A bit too brutal, but he saved our lives.
Yeah.
And therefore I thought he was a superhuman hero. Yeah. And like many heroes, not a terribly nice man. And many, obviously have many dark sides.
Now, let's come back to America. Still, I want to suggest you are interested in implementations of ideas. I mean, not just pure ideas.
No.
And I still think that this also attracted you in the States because you were in a period in which the New Dealers did, and it's probably the only example of, except possibly the Labour in 1945 to 50,
correct,
that democratic politics was directly influenced by ideas, by intellectuals, by theories, and implemented and relatively successfully.
That's absolutely true. The people I met, who became friends of mine, were by and large New Dealers.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Felix Frankfurter, for example, whatever has been said against his frivolity and his superficiality, he was a great friend of mine. He was a man of warm liberal sentiments and brought up a whole generation of liberal reformers. Ben Cohen was responsible for more New Deal legislation than anybody else. He drafted all those bills which the senators then got through. He was probably the most, in a way, the most influential figure in what might be called New Deal legislation, economic and social legislation. My contemporaries, but slightly younger than myself, some of them, like Philip Graham, who was later publisher of the Washington Post and Newsweek and all that, was a typically passionate young man who wanted to transform America. I was never a socialist, although I voted for the Labour Party steadily before the war, for obvious reasons, because of fascism, the Spanish Civil War, and the extreme anti-appeasement policies, which for me began in the 30s. Long before they were called it. I never thought Mr. Baldwin was any good. I never thought that the Conservatives in Parliament were anything but people who wanted, were deeply anti-liberal, who did not sympathize with such liberal movements as were in Europe. And after Hitler, it's quite clear that the dislike of him was insufficient to stimulate action. What they were terrified of was Russia. So was I. But it didn't, for me, follow an alliance with Germany would accomplish some kind of defense against the rise of the inundation of communism in Europe. But to go back to America, yes. These people, my friend Edward Pritchard, later went to jail, never mind for what, my friend William Graham, my friends in Washington, by and large, people I associated with, were doers.
Yeah, that's
they applied ideas
exactly
to the transformation of American social and economic life. And I'd never seen that happen before my eyes. As you say, maybe the New Deal under the welfare state under Attlee was something the same. And by that time I was back in Oxford, involved in teaching, and there was no longer anything to do with government. Because I might have been, if anyone...
Well, you had friends.
I had friends, yes. If anyone wanted me to involve myself in these activities, I might have done. But nobody ever asked me to do anything in that sphere after I came back. In America, I was deeply involved. Okay. And Americans kept on writing letters to me, saying, how could I keep out of comparable movements in England? The answer was, there was no room for me in them. Nobody thought of me as in the least useful. I don't think I would have been, but I might have been tried. But I never was.
And when you came back from America and you were so fascinated by it, did it surprise your friends? I mean, it was not common among, let's say, British, either intellectuals or, let's say, I mean, all traditions in England were anti-Americans. Aristocracy were under for one reason, labor for a different reason, and Oxford, Cambridge, I believe, too.
We're talking about the 30s?
No, 45, when you came back from America.
Labor was not anti-American at all, then.
Then it changed.
No, because Roosevelt. Yeah. They were not. It isn't so.
No, but let's say, looking from above, let's say, Roosevelt is all right, but are they...
Under, I mean, only the Truman Doctrine didn't suit the pacifists or fellow travelers or people on the Labor left. But broadly speaking, the anti-American sentiment came from humiliation of England in the 40s, because America was thought to be likely to trample over Europe as too patronizing, too rich, too strong, and that the English found it difficult to accept. Attlee was not pro-American, said. That's because he was a little Englander, fundamentally. Bevin was not pro-American.
No, he was.
Because of Palestine.
No, he was.
No, because
Palestine
was Spalding.
But I want... No.
Fundamentally, I know. The Marshall Plan, he grasped with both hands.
Bevin was pro-American from 1916, and he was the exception among the Labour leadership.
I believe you.
And Churchill was pro-American and was exception among the Conservative
because
leadership.
Because he's part of American.
And I don't know other reasons. And I mean, there were some affinities between Churchill and Bevin.
That
was one of them. And that's why the Palestine, he hated it more so because it spoiled his relationship with America.
Cripps detested America.
Of course.
So did, I'm trying to think. Dalton was not particularly anti-American. I wouldn't think.
Yes.
Not
particularly, yes.
No.
No, but...
I'm trying to think who they were, that first Labour government. Who were they?
Oh, well, I mean, the main figures were, you mentioned already.
Morrison.
Attlee, Dalton.
Morrison had no views.
No views, probably.
American, no.
Yes, and Harold Lasky, of course, was in favor, but he didn't count.
That's correct. That's correct.
No, but I mean, the general mood.
The general mood was America, big capitalist power.
Exactly.
And big capitalist power not to be trusted. Yeah. We mustn't have a country dominated by so many rich men, even if some of them were quite liberal rich men.
And on the conservative side, of course, it's aristocrats looking on parvenus.
Those are the yes, oh, yes. But that is also true of the middle classes, also to parvenus.
Yes.
That's perfectly true. I'll tell you what the position was. the position that was that here is England, an impoverished aristocrat, kept going by a proletarian nephew, humiliated by the fact that they had to live off somebody whom socially and intellectually they despised. And that created bitterness.
That was the position.
That was the position. Americans were much more pro-British after the war than the British were pro-American. During the war, the Americans were anti-British to a high degree.
They talked of the imperialist motives.
Yeah.
And,
imperialism was the main thing.
Yes.
Imperialism was the
main thing. But the degree of, Britain ought to hold grudge against America after 45, and the grudge faded rather quickly, I think.
What was the grudge?
I mean, Britain fought the war, lost its assets, America came into the war later, and America came out of the war deep power, and British second-class power. I mean, one ought to, you were sent to America inter alia to help Roosevelt to rally America public opinion when, America had to wait 2 years and so on and so forth.
In 1941, I was a British propagandist.
Yes.
In 1942, I no longer was.
Not, there was no need for it.
The war, well, America was war.
Yeah.
America
yeah.
to the war.
All right, but
there was some need for it. Yeah. Because anti-British sentiment did not cease for the war.
Yeah, I know.
The idea of helping this empire to continue to be an empire stuck in the throats of a good many even conservative Americans. It was none of my business to do anything about that because I stopped and my job changed.
But let's come back to my original question. When you came back from America, were your opinions about American intellectuals, academic universities, different from your colleagues? Did you have to argue with them?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
They were different. Yes.
That's what I thought.
I was impressed, yes.
Yeah.
I was much more pro-American than most people I met.
Yeah.
Much more. Because I'd lived there and because I found that Americans had certain virtues which Europeans lacked.
Yeah.
Which I found intently sympathetic and not dissimilar from my beloved Russians of the 19th century. You see, what I mean is this. Americans had a much broader vision than, for example, the English. They didn't see things in such minute terms. They had less taste, less discrimination, less nuance, less, so to speak, sense of the more delicate and more inner sides of life, but much bigger horizons. Much more generosity of temper, even politically. The idea that everything was done for the sake of power of America, which people like Chomsky think, was just false. There's a great deal of genuine altruism.
Oh, I agree.
And there still is.
Yeah. There is idealism in American foreign policy.
There is idealism in America which is never allowed for in Europe. They're thought to be materialist, riches hunting country. This is not so. Watergate could never have happened in a country which was not morally inclined.
Yeah.
Never. Rightly or wrongly. Nothing this happened. Every American president who was ever elected before Johnson was always elected because he was thought to be morally upright figure, likely to be generous and morally decent. Very many of them weren't, but they were thought to be before they were elected. The first president who was not thought to be a nice man was Johnson. Now, nice he was not thought. Clever, able, interesting, important. Nixon was not thought to be a nice man, in spite of the enormous vote.
Yeah.
After that, they were all thought to be. After that, they were all nice again. No, never thought Johnson was a nice fellow.
And did you establish already deep relations with academics, with universities?
No.
Not yet?
No, not at all. I didn't. I never had anything to do with academics in Washington. I met academics who happened to be American
officials. They were in Washington, officials. I mean, economists.
In Washington.
And,
Queen University had nothing to do with it.
Since when did you start?
When I went to Harvard in 49.
And did you like it?
At first, I couldn't really find my feet. I did quite know it functioned. In the end, I became extremely fond of it, yes. We admired it very much.
Yeah.
There were things in it which I regretted, I'll tell you, things which I wrote down rather tactlessly. When I had a long period in bed with a slip disc, I had nothing better to do, and I was asked by Time and Tide, which is a
statement on
it. It was a very minor periodical with Lady Rhonda. She said to produce a kind of diary, like thing, reflections. Among my reflections was that too many American academics who I had met felt guilt about teaching useless subjects. The professors of Greek were not entirely happy unless they could also claim to be doing something socially useful for a hospital, for do something for the poor, I mean, do something decent and good. And there was a general sense that the business of human beings was to improve mankind. The Germans called Menschen Verbesserung.
And you criticized it?
Yes. I said there was absolutely no reason for not doing things intellectually because they were interesting. So because one liked it.
That's very interesting because we bring to another question that will surprise you. But I want to check myself now. I suggested once that what attracted you in American university life was the combination of, on the one hand, the American tradition that you liked, as you described earlier, and the contribution, of course, of the high-standard academic that the European exiles brought.
Yes.
That this breed produced possibly the best universities for a generation. Am I right?
I don't think the people from Europe, the European exiles, produced quite as much, gave as much benefit to America as is sometimes supposed. In some subjects, yes. In other subjects, not. In the physical, obviously, in the natural sciences, enormous.
Yeah.
The impact was terrific.
Yeah.
Not very, but pretty good for it.
Yeah.
They by no means didn't lag behind.
Yeah, but still, I mean,
perfectly good Nobel Prize winners before the war and so on. But still, the exiles, from Einstein onwards, made a great deal of difference. I mean, particularly, of course, physicists in Los Alamos, the bomb. But altogether, they were both morally and intellectually made a difference. Some of them were very honorable, high-minded, noble people, some of the scientists, particularly the Jewish scientists. Exceptional lot. Morally exceptionally high-graded. Historians, I'm not so sure there were was a great influx from Europe. There were some German historians, of course, who came to Europe, who probably raised the standard in those subjects. I'm trying to think
of what historians, of course.
Art historians made a total difference.
The whole difference.
In England, too. The Warburg Institute.
Yes, the Warburg Institute.
Transformed art history in America, and these people transformed art history in America.
No doubt about it.
From Panofsky and others.
And everyone.
Yes, certainly. Witkowa, Panofsky.
Witkowa, Shapiro.
They were post-war, of course. Yes. Witkowa came after the war.
Yes,
it was England during the war.
Yeah, yeah.
But, there were
but still, it's the same.
Still, the impact
I'm
of that kind
about
of thing.
The
of that kind of thing. The German art historians made a difference, certainly. Though they did have very good art historians of their own, better than ours. Meyer Shapiro was a better art historian than any native born.
He's a native born.
He was born in Shavli.
You know that type?
He was born in Lithuania.
And what?
Age of 10.
Because I considered him to be also an exile. I didn't
know.
I didn't know he was.
He went to school.
I include him in the.
East side.
I see.
East side, New York.
I see.
Straight east side, New York. Oh, no, no.
I see.
Typical New York Jewish intellectual.
I see.
Like Sidney Hook. Like the rest of it. Like all the left wing intelligentsia of the 1930s. Like Lionel Trilling. That was his generation, and those were the people. These people, you see? Like all these people, like Max Lerner, a lot of people like that, you see? Now, in some subjects, for example, psychology and sociology, the impact was not entirely from beneficent.
It was extreme, but not that good.
Very strong.
Yes, but not to the good.
I'm rather prejudiced in this matter. It seemed to me they introduced an enormous amount of European smoke, and writing in America, with sociological and psychological, became much more unreadable as a result.
That's about sociology,
jargon
I agree with you entirely.
In a big way.
Now, what about psychology?
Well, psychoanalysis, of course, was no doubt improved by the entry of the Europeans, but...
Now, what's your evaluation of the contribution to a psychoanalysis to society? I mean, what's your attitude?
In America, it became, particularly in New York, and particularly in Jewish circles, became a kind of religion. In England, when people are psychoanalyzed, they don't talk about it to other people. In America, it's perfectly normal to say, I'm very sorry,
I have
to go away for 2 hours, I have to go and see my psychoanalyst. It was an absolute, it took over in a very big way, and entered every sphere. of thought and action. It became a tremendous movement, sometimes for the good and sometimes not. The application of psychoanalysis to the interpretation of history did not lead to brilliant results. Not even to biography, which should have been, nor to something to which it really didn't fit. And for that, Dr. Freud cannot be blamed.
But let's say, now, 60 years after, or 80 years after, psychoanalysis was born, what's your general observation of its contribution to society, to history? I mean, what's...
Psychoanalysis, don't ask me. I've read very little Freud, I'm ashamed to say.
No,
don't ask me. I really don't know enough.
No, but no need to read.
It's made a difference.
You know about the impact. You know about the impact.
Yes, of course, made a difference. It's made an enormous difference.
To the good or to the... I know. But to the good or to the...
Both ways. Both ways, naturally.
Because I think that he contributed to immorality.
Let me give you an example. The present fuss which is going on about, for example, with children? The tampering with children, what is it called? What is the thing
called?
Abuse. Child abuse.
Child abuse.
Could not have been discussed if there had not been psychoanalysis. The question is, do the children imagine they were abused, or were they abused? And what if so, the effects? Freud invented all that. He was accused, as you know, by his enemies, by his critics, of first thinking the abuse was genuine, and later, because he was thought to shock people too much, changing it to the idea of having mythologizing it. But the whole subject wouldn't be discussed today for Freud. It's a typical way in which ordinary topics for people who've never read Freud, perhaps who've never heard of Freud, take it for granted that there is a field of investigation there, and a moral field too. The effect of Freudianism morally, what do you think? Why do
negative.
You think it?
I
negative, why?
Because
we're not responsible.
Particularly the very not Freud, but psychoanalysis in general. I mean, an average young man who has gone through it can explain everything that he did wrong, and explanation sometimes is justification.
Now what you're really saying is that the idea of personal responsibility was weakened by the fact that you could give it, and that of course is my thesis all my life.
And you should be very critical of it because of your life belief and
speak about it. My essay on historical inevitability is about shuffling off what is personal responsibility.
No, I know.
Psychologically as well. Now I'll tell you.
So why didn't you attack psychoanalysis?
Because I didn't attack psychoanalysis.
Because that's the one very ruinous thing, personal responsibility in the 20th century.
Well, this is perfectly true. But you see, the good which psychoanalysis did is that in cases of people who do speak up to condemn, it's obviously possible to rescue people in a psychologically difficult or even potentially criminal condition by applying probably psychoanalytical cures. Therefore, you could say that sympathy for the victim or sympathy for what might be called abnormal or neurotic or psychotic conditions was much increased by the teaching of psychoanalysis. On the other hand, you are perfectly right. The idea of individual responsibility was removed both by Marxism and by psychoanalysis. By two Jews. But I'll tell you, partly even by Schopenhauer, I can tell you what it really is. Once you believe there are occult forces, governors, whatever they are, whether they are divine, whether they are mysterious underground forces, I mean nature in a disguised form as it is in Schopenhauer, mysterious cosmic powers which toss us about wherever they will without any knowledge on our part, which we cannot help, as there is no pattern. Whether they are economic forces of which we are not aware, which transform our consciousness into false consciousness, so that we misinterpret everything systematically because of economic motives of which we are not fully aware. Whether it is some kind of psychological drives, secret drives, which transform us in various ways, for which I'll ask other people, of which we are not aware, so to speak. Mind you, in all these cases, there's always a certain amount of cheating. The psychoanalyst doesn't think that he is subject to irrational drives. The patient is, but he's not.
I know.
The communist leader doesn't think that he is liable to false consciousness. Everybody else is. For example, Mannheim, who is one of the great influences on the idea of psychological determinism, whatever it's called, of
Karl Mannheim. Yes.
Karl Mannheim. What is the thing called?
I know what you mean.
Some kind of psychological or sociological relativity.
Yeah.
You see, all that of this called sociology of knowledge.
Yeah.
Now you see, Mannheim, because he realized this, was rather troubled, and was comparatively honest, though not in many other respects he was not, I think, invented the idea that above the teeming mass of mankind, there is something called the freischwebende Intelligenz, freely wafting intelligentsia, which is free of these things, which can take an impartial. These are the people to whom power should be given. These ought to be the government of mankind, just as H.G. Wells thought scientists should. Because they are free from the prejudices, the drives, the whole irrational, so to speak, apparatus, the whole mass, you know, of irrational stuff which they crush with others.
It was his version of Plato's sages.
The guardians.
Yeah. Guardians. I didn't want to pursue with it, but I
didn't want to point a psychoanalyst of medically.
Yeah.
Probably done quite a lot of good.
Yes.
As a doctrine, yeah. I find it most unacceptable.
That's what I know. When I first read his doctrine of disability, I told a colleague, I haven't known him. It was before I knew him. I told a friend, I am sure that one day he will produce an attack on psychoanalysis.
I never shall.
But I see what you. I see why.
Too many of my friends are addicted to it.
Yes.
I hate being enemies. Yeah. All I can tell you, some of my best friends were passionate supporters of psychoanalysis. None of these people are free from quite conspicuous neuroses themselves.
Yeah.
I've never known a completely well-balanced personality.
I know only one.
Who is that?
But I'm not sure she's psychoanalyst, by the way. She's psychiatrist. She's the widow of Amos de Chalit, and she's the mother of a young man, Avner de Chalit. He's now coming to write his thesis with David Miller. And he's a very nice man. I'll bring him to you. Yes. He'll be in St. Anthony's, but he's writing.
I've never, you know, I've met David Miller, but I couldn't put a face on him.
I don't know him.
Not one.
But one moment, back to psychoanalysis. You know who, by the way, was one of the first to be...
What is he writing about, this young man?
He's now coming to write. He's occupied with progress and social justice. I mean, this progress. I'll bring it to one day to him, to you, but later. Now, you know that Montague Norman, the Bank of England, he went to Switzerland for psychoanalysis in the early 20s.
By who?
I think Jung.
Jung.
Now, was it? I know it from his biography. Was it common in those days?
No. I wouldn't have thought it was.
That's what I asked.
No.
A man of his background.
Exactly. Uncommon. He must have suffered.
Yeah.
He must have had some kind of obvious abnormality.
He suffered to his last day. And England suffered because of his suffering.
I did that too.
But, uh-huh.
And you probably also talked to his stepchildren. And the editor of the Sunday Telegraph. Peregrine Westphal.
Is he step?
Stepson.
He's a nice man, isn't he? Oh, no.
Quite nice.
I don't know.
Mildly pro-Israel. Very
yes,
right way.
Yeah. I don't know why I have previous questions, but if we deal with psychoanalysis, do you think that Protestants need more psychoanalysis than Catholics? Because
I can't analyze.
Because America, England, France was less taken by
it. I'll tell you what I think about that.
And it will bring me into a philosophical question.
There is something very crude about that.
Yeah.
Every people who live under discipline very seldom have nervous breakdowns, psychological breakdowns, whatever the discipline. During the war, neurotics who join the army do not have choices and consequently do not have breakdowns and do not commit suicide. Suicide in the army is extremely rare. Real Catholics live under discipline. Jews, pious Jews, live under discipline. Protestants do not live under discipline. They are left to their own private consciences. That creates difficulties. Liberals don't have undiscipline at all. Intelligentsia are completely free of it. The freer, the more the great, the more choices they have, the more liberated they are, the more liable they are to certain forms of psychological malaise.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It may lead to genius, but it certainly also leads to terrible inner problems.
Now, from the point of view, from the sheer theological attitude of Catholicism, Calvinism, and Protestant. I mean, let's say a Catholic, Calvinist, Protestant, who are devout, who are, in terms of personal responsibility, who would have in a deeper sense of personal responsibility?
Oh, I'm sure the Protestants, of course, Calvinists.
Calvinists.
In spite of
that's
being
what I thought.
Determinists.
Yeah.
There's some paradox there.
Yeah, that I know.
There's
know.
A paradox.
That we know.
Yeah, but the same is true of some Catholics.
Yeah.
Also predestination, etc. Yes, Calvinists, they have a deeper sense of responsibility and therefore suffer greater miseries.
That's
the Catholics, so to speak, devolve all that onto the Church. The Church knows best.
That's it.
The Rabbanim, so the Jews do. Yeah. Those really are pious, have some kind of rabbi who tells them. Calvinists do not have a Calvinist minister who really rules their lives to quite the extent to which Jews and Catholics.
So I think that, let's say, in America, one can assume that Calvinists would not have been attracted to psychoanalysts, unlike, let's say, an average Protestant.
No, on the contrary, why not?
Because
Calvinists suffer more.
Suffer more, but...
And therefore, we haven't begged
them. But he doesn't look for... I mean, psychoanalysis would be a contradictory to Calvinism in the way it solves this problem.
They don't think about... Nobody goes to psychoanalysts. And goes to psychoanalysis because of the general theory.
I see what you mean.
They go to be cured by these wise men.
Yeah.
You see? I mean, the doctrine, of course, is not compatible.
But I think I'll try to find out.
Mind you, one mustn't be unfair. Psychoanalysis doesn't think that your entire life is determined by forces which you are doing no control. After you've been psychoanalyzed, you can govern yourself and you can be responsible. That's the theory.
I know. No, I'm not that critical of psychoanalysis as I might have seen.
But
in the point of personal responsibility, I thought we ought to clarify. Generally speaking, I think that the impact of psychoanalysis, it has its
in
positive...
In theory, psychoanalysis promises return to personal responsibility. After you've discovered what pushes you, it won't push you.
Exactly. I agree. Yes. And I think that in some ways, its influence on history was positive. Not the wild psychohistory, but let's say, I think that the impact, let's say, on Nemir was not bad as an historian.
On
Nemia.
No.
Yeah.
According to Will,
even the application of the term collective trauma to historiography that he did to France in the 19th century, for me it's a key to understanding any phenomenon in the 20th
century. I agree, it's quite useful. Quite useful for me. Now
I'm going to entirely different question.
But Nemia was a deeply neurotic man.
I know.
He
did twice. He's one of the few people who went twice to do psychoanalysis.
In Vienna?
Once in Vienna and once, I think, in England. In Vienna in the 20s,
yes.
And then here for many years. But historiography the obvious subjects we did later. I'm going to ask you a very, I don't know, odd question. Do you think that you have matured early in life? And I'll add a question that might take you by surprise. I think that being taken by opera, loving opera, the way you did, usually comes later in life. And you will tell me if you had many friends of your age whom you could discuss opera the way you were taken by it. But that's one example only. And not obvious question. I mean, people would ask you about your maturity, probably, you know, your mind, your writing.
What do you call early in life?
Pardon?
What do you mean by early in life? When I was an undergraduate, I could discuss opera with other undergraduates.
Undergraduate days is very early in life.
And there are plenty of other people for me to talk to.
opera, really?
Yes. In Oxford.
So you know that in those days you will not find a young man, except one who was brought up, probably. Opera had been mocked at, as a...
Oxford University and Opera Club. There were at least 100 undergraduates who probably belonged to it.
And
it was quite natural to go to Covent Garden to hear opera. It was not abnormal.
Yeah, to go to opera sometimes is a social
even
thing.
To discuss. No.
No, I mean, the way you... I mean,
not for undergraduates.
How many of your age wrote about opera?